From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, women fighting for inclusion in Hollywood. We talk with actor Gina Davis, who's featured in the new documentary, This Changes Everything. She's also the founder of the Gina Davis Institute on Gender in Media, which advocates for more and better women's roles. She gives advice like this on how to make scripts more gender balanced.
Go through and cross out a bunch of first names and put female first names, and then now they're female. And I say, and then cast me. And they laugh, and I say, but I'm not kidding.
We'll also be joined by director Maria Geis, whose activism led to an EEOC investigation into systemic discrimination against women directors. Later, photographer Bruce Talaman talks about documenting the great soul, funk, and R&B performers of the 70s. He took photos for Soul Train. My guest Gina Davis starred in two movies about female empowerment, Thelma and Louise and A League of Their Own. But when she got older and roles started to dry up, she realized how unempowered women were in Hollywood. In 2004, she founded the Gina Davis Institute on Gender in Media to get the actual data comparing the number and types of male and female roles, and to use that data to convince the industry of the need for change. She's an executive producer of and is featured in the new documentary, This Changes Everything, about how women in Hollywood are pushing for more representation in front of and behind the camera. She's receiving an honorary Oscar this year, the Jean Hirschhalt Humanitarian Award, at a special ceremony in October. Also with us is director Maria Geis, who's featured in the film too. After feeling that she was shut out of directing because she's a woman, she became an activist. Her work led to an ongoing EEOC, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, investigation into systemic discrimination against women directors, as well as an ACLU campaign against discrimination. Gina Davis, Maria Geis, welcome to Fresh Air. Gina, I want to start with you. You used to make a movie a year. When did things start to slow down in your acting career?
Well, it was pretty dramatic. It was once there was a four in front of my age. And, you know, I had heard about that for a long time, that people said that things change when you turn 40 or when you're in your 40s. But I didn't expect it to be literal. And I also expected it to be not true anymore by the time I would get to that age. I very much expected that that would not be the case.
Well, did you think of it as discrimination against older women? Did you think of it as there not being enough roles for women in their 40s, which really isn't very old? Or did you think, oh, it's me. No one wants me anymore.
Oh, no. I was very upset and angry at that happening to me. I didn't think, oh, it's me at all. I thought this is incredibly unfair, and I don't want other people deciding that I have to work less, taking away opportunities. I felt very unhappy with having that sort of imposed on me by other people.
How did you decide to create your institute?
It was very specific, actually. My daughter was a toddler, and I decided she was old enough to start watching preschool shows. So I sat down with her, and the very first show I turned on and watched with her, I pretty much immediately noticed something, and I thought, wait a minute, how many female characters are in this show? And I was counting on my hands as I held her in my lap, and it was horrifying, and I was absolutely stunned. And then I saw it everywhere. I showed her, you know, G-rated videos and little kids' movies and TV shows, and you know, obviously there's some exceptions to that. You know, the Teletubbies are gender balanced. I don't know if you can tell, but for the most part, I saw appalling gender imbalance, and I think most people, and certainly I did, assume that kids' entertainments are harmless, that they might even be good for kids. You know, some shows are researched and all that, and certainly harmless. But this struck me very deeply that we're training kids from the beginning, from the minute one of absorbing popular culture, that women and girls are not as important as men and boys, and they're not as valuable to our society as men and boys. And it seemed that in the 21st century, this was a horrible message to be sending, and very, very shocking.
So the Gina Davis Institute on Gender in Media has done a lot of research on the numbers. Give us some of the numbers that you find most disturbing.
Well, you know, we found that for every two speaking male characters, there's one female speaking character, and that there's an appalling amount of hypersexualization of female characters, even in G-rated movies. And the female characters are very often narrowly stereotyped, hypersexualized, or not really integral to the plot. There's far fewer movies with a female lead character. I'm talking about family-rated films. And when we first looked at TV shows, kids, the ratio of male to female characters on kids' programs specifically made for them had the worst ratio of male to female characters.
Maria Geis, let me move on to you. Things were looking good for you after film school. You were signed to a big agency. The first film you directed was shown at the Cannes Film Festival. You were attached to other projects. What happened after that?
My first feature film directing job out of graduate film school was in England, not in the United States. So when I got back from Cannes, I was represented at William Morris Agency, and basically nothing happened. I never got another paying job.
Ever.
You know, I did a lot of script writing and doctoring, and but no primetime TV shows, even though I observed for hundreds of hours on major TV shows like Dick Wolf's Law and Order.
So what about other women you knew from film school? Were they getting work?
Well, that was the thing. You know, what we tend to do when we don't succeed is to blame ourselves. And women were so siloed off in this industry, we really didn't have any means of communication. But what I did also as Gina was start looking at the numbers. And I started to notice that only 4% of studio features were directed by women, and only 13% of episodic TV shows were directed by women. And I couldn't get the numbers on women in commercials, which is the most lucrative category of directing. But I spoke to some big executives in the commercial world who told me that the number was less than 1%. So I began to think, you know, this is maybe not just about me. And even if my own career is just about me, that doesn't answer for all the incredible talented women everywhere that are not able to contribute their voices to our entertainment media storytelling. And that, for me, became a battle worth fighting for.
So what was your strategy to try to open the door to more women directors?
Well, I understood very quickly that the numbers in of themselves inferred violations of Title VII. So I knew that we could invoke that law to be able to change things in a very significant way.
This is the Equal Opportunity Law.
Yes, Title VII, which was written into law in 1964 by President Johnson. And I started to do research. I went down to the downtown LA courthouse, and I found that six very courageous women in the Directors Guild in 1979 had got the DGA, our union, to file a class action lawsuit against several major studios. And that action alone sent the numbers skyrocketing from 0.5% to 16%. In just 10 years, from 1985 to 1995. So I knew the way to move the numbers and to make real significant change was through legal action. And that's what I set my mind to do.
So you went to the ACLU and then the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission became involved too. What have they each done?
I first went to the EEOC in 2013, and I could see that I was not going to make any headway with them. So I gathered all my articles and all the work that I had done, and I had even written the beginnings of a legal brief, and I brought it to the ACLU, where I met Melissa Goodman and Ariella McDowell, and I explained to them why I thought that this was so significant on a global level. And they got really excited, and little by little I introduced them to a group of my female colleagues, and we started to have meetings with them, and they started to reach out to interview many, many women, as many women directors as they could. And then after about a year and a half, they told me they were going to pursue it. And in May 2015, the New York Times published the ACLU's 15-page letter to the EEOC and two other government agencies calling for an industry-wide federal investigation into systemic discrimination against women directors, and that was an extraordinary triumph.
So the EEOC has been conducting an investigation into systemic discrimination against women directors. My understanding is they don't make their investigation public. So do you have any idea where things stand?
So in 5 months after they received that letter from the ACLU, they began their investigation. The EEOC functions in total confidentiality, so there's no way for us to really know where the investigation is, even though it's now 3 years and 7 months going.
Gina Davis, let me bring you back into the conversation. On TV, you have women like Shonda Rhimes, Ava DuVernay, who's also in movies, and Reese Witherspoon, not only doing shows that have women in them, but also, certainly with Ava DuVernay, she makes a point of hiring women directors and often women directors of color for her series Queen Sugar. So, it seems like a lot of the change is happening from women like that who are creating the change themselves.
Absolutely, which is fantastic. They just determined to do it, and they're very creative, and they make it happen. There's also people like Ryan Murphy, who has that initiative called Half, where he just decided and announced that half of his cast and crew were always going to be female, and he just does it. There's no question about it. He's just decided that that's what he's going to do. And, that's obviously an option that everybody can take.
A parallel issue to what we've been talking about inclusion of women. Parallel issue is the predatory behavior of certain men in Hollywood, directors, actors, heads of companies. Harvey Weinstein, of course, comes to mind. And I'm wondering what impact you think that might be having on the inclusion issue, because we've seen how some men in Hollywood have misused their power to assault or harass women. And that might be a compelling argument for hiring more women to prevent
Absolutely.
That kind of behavior. So I'm wondering if you think it's having that kind of effect.
Well, I definitely see a big shift happening in Hollywood in the past couple of years since Me Too and Time's Up. The main thing that's very different is now it's completely okay to talk about this stuff. I think my peers and I were always operating under the assumption that you should never complain about anything. God forbid you complain about your salary not being equal or being harassed or mistreated or discriminated against, because they'll just get somebody else. It'll ruin your career, was the thinking. But it's profoundly not the case right now. You hear so many women speaking up when they encounter injustice and and openly talking about it. So I think that's a big change that's happened.
So, Gina Davis, I have a few questions for you about your career. So you started your career as a model. Was that because you thought that was the way you could break in?
Absolutely, yes. I knew I wanted to be in movies as opposed to theater. I decided that I would try becoming a model first because at that time, Christie Brinkley and Lauren Hutton were being offered parts in movies, and I thought, okay, well, I'll just become a model, and then they'll just offer me parts because obviously it's so much easier to become a supermodel. But that was my plan.
And it turned out, what was wrong with that plan?
Well, I mean, come on. You know, I mean, both are kind of unattainable. It ultimately all worked out for me, but the likelihood of becoming a famous model was actually pretty slim. And I didn't. I did get work, and it was through my model agency that I got my first acting job.
So part of your work was modeling for Victoria's Secret. Your first movie role, Tootsie, you're in your underwear film. Because Dustin Hoffman, who plays this man who can't get roles, finally auditions for a role posing as a woman in a soap opera. And when after he gets the role, he walks dressed as a woman into the dressing room and sees you there in your underwear, and you're not...
Phased.
Yes, you're not phased by seeing Dustin Hoffman walk in because you think he's really a woman. He, right. However, is very phased and doesn't know where to put his eyes. So right. Did being a model for Victoria's Secret lead to having this part where you're in your underwear in the dressing room?
Well, it did in a way. It was my first audition, and they had called model agencies to say, send any models who can act for an audition. And I went, and they said, wear a bathing suit under your clothes, because if you do well at the reading, they'll ask to see you in your bathing suit. And so I did, and it was just, you know, doing a video with a casting assistant. And they didn't ask, after I read the part, they didn't ask to see my bathing suit. So I figured, what were the odds anyway? I was going to be in a Sidney Pollack movie with Dustin Hoffman. So I never thought about it again. And I had gone to Paris to do the collections. And in the meantime, Sidney Pollack saw my audition tape and said, hey, I like her. She's interesting. Where's her bathing suit stuff? Oh, we forgot. We'll get her back. Oh, no, we can't. She's in Paris. Well, do they have any photos of her in a bathing suit? And so they send over a Victoria's Secret catalog, and I got the part.
That's really great. And I just think it's so interesting that we're having this conversation about women's empowerment and inclusion of women, and the first part of your career revolves around being in your underwear.
Well, the bigger part was that Sidney liked my audition.
No, I know, but you're in your underwear in it. Of course, it's all a
it's
joke.
True.
It's all played for comedy.
It's all for comedy.
Yeah,
yes.
And I have a feeling being really tall, like you're 6 feet tall, came into play here too, because there's more of you for Dustin Hoffman to be phased by when he walks in. It's like he's short, you're really tall. And, you know, you're dressed in your underwear, so it's even more, like, imposing and for him kind of embarrassing because he's a man who is finding it all very arousing and he shouldn't be there because he's posing as a woman. Anyways.
Right.
So what did you learn being on set? You had a small role, but you were with Sidney Pollack. You were working with Dustin Hoffman. You can pick up a lot on a set. What were you looking for? And what did you come away with?
Well, I was astounded that it happened. But on the other hand, I sort of felt like, well, this is what was supposed to happen. This was my plan. and so it kind of made sense in that way. And I was mostly thrilled that my first job was not playing a corpse in a morgue on a soap opera or something. It was like an amazing introduction, and I was really worried about coming off as if I didn't know anything, that people would be saying, she doesn't even know where to stand or what to do, and so I'd never asked any questions, and I didn't know that you didn't have to come every day. And so you only come when you're shooting, but I came every day at the beginning of the day and grabbed my chair and put it next to Sidney and sat next to him all day, every day, making the movie. And it was fantastic. But nobody, and least of all him, nobody ever said, you realize you don't have to come every day. Maybe they just thought I really wanted to, that I wanted to be such a student of film that was my goal.
But that kind of was your goal.
I guess it was.
My guests are actor Gina Davis and director Maria Geis. They're both featured in the new documentary, This Changes Everything, about the campaign for more representation of women in front of and behind the camera in movies and TV. After a break, I'll talk more with Gina Davis about her movie career. And Bruce Talamon will talk about taking photos of soul, funk, and R&B stars of the 70s. He was the photographer for Soul Train and took photos for Jet, Ebony, and the black-owned L.A. newspaper Soul. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Imagine how it feels to have an award-winning team of mortgage experts make the home buying process smoother for you. With a history of industry-leading online lending technology, Rocket Mortgage is changing the game. Visit rocketmortgage.com/freshair. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Push button, get mortgage.
We've been talking with actor Gina Davis and director Maria Geis about the campaign for more representation of women behind and in front of the camera in movies and TV. In this part of the interview, I'm going to talk more with Davis about her own movie career. I want to ask you about Thelma and Louise. I'm going to ask you to describe the premise.
Oh, gosh, I haven't really ever had to describe what it's about. It's about two women who grab a hold of their fate and refuse to relinquish control, no matter how far it takes them, that they remain in charge of their destiny.
More specifically, you play a woman in an unhappy marriage, and you want to let down your hair, as you put it. So you and your friend, played by Susan Sarandon, they go on a trip together, have a lot of drinks in a bar. Guy comes up to you, asks to dance with you. You go out to the parking lot with him, and he starts to rape you. And you try really hard to, throw him off of you. He's got you pinned against a car. And then Susan Sarandon comes out. She's got a handgun, pulls it on him, asks him to apologize. He refuses. She ends up shooting him. And then you both go on the lam because you feel like, who's going to believe you?
That's a good description.
And so it's a kind of, I think at the time people were comparing it to Butch Cassidy. And the ending's kind of similar where, you know, they kind of ride off a cliff and you drive off a cliff. And it's a buddy movie. And the buddy movies were always men's movies. And this is a buddy movie that's a women's movie. Right. So what impact do you think it had, both on audiences but also on Hollywood? Because it was a big hit. I'm sure it made a lot of money.
It did well, and it also struck a nerve that none of us expected. Nobody was going into this thinking, we're going to really make a statement with this, or this is going to be a powerful message for anybody. It was a small budget, and we hoped somebody would see it and not object to the ending. But we were stunned at the reaction that was instant. Cover of Time magazine and all that stuff. And a lot of negative reaction in the press, too. Like, oh, no, the world is ruined now. The women have guns. So it was all very shocking and great. Because what it really, well, first of all, I'll tell you how it affected me. The sudden change in how people reacted when they recognized me was very, very pronounced. It was night and day, where before they might say, hey, Beetlejuice, or something. Now they were saying, oh, I have to tell you what I thought about this movie, and this is how many times I saw it, and my friend and I acted out your trip. And I'd be like, which part exactly? But But the biggest reaction of all was the press saying, like the title of the movie, this is going to change everything. Now we will see so many more female buddy pictures, female road movies or whatever, and movies about female friendship. And I was sure they must be right and waiting for this fabulous future that was coming.
Gina, I want to ask you about one of the recurring roles that you have now, and that's on this series Glow, the Netflix series Glow, which is about women wrestlers in the 1980s. And your role is as the entertainment director of a casino. And there's a scene where you come out in... why don't you describe the costume?
Oh, I don't know which one you mean. I had
the one with the feathers and
the one with the feathers and rhinestones.
Yes, that one.
Well, so my character they told me from the beginning was a former showgirl who, when she was getting too old to do that, went into management and was able to create a successful career for herself that way. And I was like, I was a huge fan of Glow and very much wanted to do it. But I said, at some point, you've got to get me into a showgirl costume because it's kind of a fantasy of mine to wear one of those things, you know, with the giant headdress and all that. And I just wanted an excuse to be able to do that.
And you also are an archer, like bow and arrow archery. And you even competed to be on the Olympic archery team. How did you take up archery?
Well, it was completely random in some ways. So I had been very unathletic as a kid. I didn't want to try any sports because I call it physically shy. Being so tall, I just didn't want anybody to look at me, especially if I was going to be failing at a sport. So I never tried anything. And then I had to play the best baseball player anyone has ever seen hold a bat. In a league of their own, yeah. So I had a lot of training. And very quickly, the coaches were saying, you know, you have a lot of untapped athletic ability. And so I learned at 36 that I actually was coordinated. And then for a couple of movies after that, I had to learn other physical skills like horseback riding and taekwondo and fencing and ice skating and a lot of stuff. And I was kind of good at all of it. So I decided I wanted to take up a sport in the real life way and not the movie version. And then I was watching the Olympics in Atlanta on TV and saw the archery competing. And I thought, wow, that is so beautiful and dramatic. And I'd like to see if I could do that. So at 41... I took it up and then became absolutely obsessed, as I do with things. And 2.5 years later, I was a semifinalist for the Olympic trials.
What did you like about archery? Was it a centering thing for you? Focus?
Yeah, it's very centering and focusing. It's a lonely sport because you're out there for hours every day shooting by yourself. But I loved it. And I was so shocked when my coach said, after just a few months, well, now you got to start competing. I'm like, oh, my God, no. He said, no, that's the whole point, is competing. It's really fun and incredibly challenging. And that's when you really are tested with your mental abilities. Because once you have a really good shot, your job is to recreate it exactly and every time. Everything gets in the way of that. Every possible thought you have, every different circumstance, like competing, if you're nervous, your shot's going to be off. And so it's just a battle with yourself the whole time.
A battle with yourself to not battle with yourself.
Exactly. 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 But the other thing that I loved about it was that it's measured by points. And I had spent so much time in a field where you're measured by people's judgment, you know, where you know you're approved of by others' opinions rather than factual merit, and so that was really fun.
Gina Davis, Maria Geis, thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Thanks so much, Terry.
Gina Davis is featured in and as an executive producer of the new documentary, This Changes Everything, about the campaign for better representation of women in front of and behind the camera in movies and TV. In October, at a special ceremony, she'll receive an honorary Oscar, the Jean Hirschholt Humanitarian Award. We also heard from director Maria Geis, who's also featured in the film This Changes Everything. After we take a short break, we'll hear from photographer Bruce Talaman, whose photos of soul, funk, and R&B stars of the 70s and early 80s are collected in a book. This is Fresh Air.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Curio Collection by Hilton, inviting you to choose from a fascinating list of independent hotels around the world, each with its own story to tell. The Candler Hotel in Atlanta and the C. Baldwin in Houston are two of the collection's finest examples of repurposing history to create distinct experiences for their guests. Named after local legends, soda magnate Asa Griggs Candler and the mother of Houston, Charlotte Baldwin. Are you curious? Visit Hilton.com/NPR.
It has already been an eventful summer in politics.
Yeah, between the 2020 debates and the president's battle over immigration, there's a lot going on.
And when there's news you need to know about, the NPR Politics podcast is there to tell you what happened.
Not to mention, we're hitting the road so you can meet all of the 2020 contenders.
Oh, NPR is going to drive me completely crazy.
The NPR Politics podcast.
Subscribe!
Aretha Franklin, Marvin Gaye, Al Green, Earth, Wind & Fire, Parliament Funkadelic, Diana Ross, Donna Summer, Barry White, Bob Marley, Patti LaBelle are just some of the many performers our guest Bruce Talaman has photographed on stage and off. A book collecting his music photos from 1972 to 82 is titled Soul, R&B, Funk. Talaman got his start doing photos for the black-owned L.A. newspaper Soul. That helped lead the way to freelancing for Jet and Ebony magazines, photographing musicians for record companies, and becoming the photographer for Soul Train. Talaman went on to shoot still photos for various movies, working with people like Eddie Murphy, Paul Rubens, Tom Hanks, and Steven Spielberg. Talaman covered Jesse Jackson's 1984 presidential bid, where he met his wife, NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates. Talaman spoke with guest contributor Sonari Glinton.
Welcome to Fresh Air. You know, I have to say, I'm amazed at the access you got. So when you look at photos, there's Patti LaBelle. This is one of my favorite photos with her feet up on a conference table. Or Stevie Wonder late night at Roscoe's Chicken. This is something that I wonder about. It's getting that access. There's a photo of Donna Summer.
Yes.
Minimal makeup. She's got her bare knees pulled up against her. And she's essentially looking down
right.
the barrel of the lens at
right.
you, at the viewer.
Right.
And it is so sweet and intimate. And this seems early in your career. How does this photo come
about? Well, this was an interesting... This was Casablanca Records and Filmworks, her record label, was promoting an album that was coming out in 1977. And they wanted to reach this, you know, this black audience. And they would do this sometimes to the black press. They would give what were called handouts, where they'd have another photographer shoot it, and you know, some Hollywood glamour photographer would shoot it. They'd almost even write the story, and quite frankly, you know, a lot of black newspapers and groups would not have the manpower. They couldn't go to a concert. They couldn't, you know, they couldn't be there. So they would take these handouts and they would print them. And Regina said,
and this is the editor of Soul
magazine. The editor of Soul said, if you want to reach my audience, you have to allow my photographers and my writers access. And so they reluctantly said, okay, you've got 20 minutes. Well, we had set up on the day that we were supposed to shoot Donna for the cover. We're there 3 hours early. Well, who walks in but Donna Summer? And she looks at the setup and... You know, they had told her that it was going to be, you know, 20 minutes in and out. And she looks and she says, oh, you brothers are serious. She stayed for 4 hours, Sonari. Maybe 6 months later, when Ebony Magazine, which was the big African-American magazine of record, they said, do you have a photographer that you work with? because they were going to defer to her. And she says, yes, Bruce Tolliman. That Ebony cover was my first national cover. All right. So, you know, from there, a lot of things happened after that.
You transitioned at some point to work for another Chicago legend, Don Cornelius, the founder of
Soul Train.
And in the book, you tell an anecdote that I really love. And it's of Don Cornelius, and he's standing in shadow with James Brown. And I love this photo, not necessarily because the photo is so great, but because the story behind it is so great. For those who don't know, Don Cornelius starts Soul Train, and he runs it for over 30 years. He's a music entrepreneur who was a Chicago DJ. And there's this, like, there's this moment where James Brown, who is a god of rock and roll, R&B, and everything, is standing next to Don Cornelius, and he's surprised by all the stuff that's happening around him.
First of all, when I look back at that photograph, you've got James Brown and you've got Don Cornelius, two black men who were at the height of their powers and their careers in 1973. They're sitting there on the set, or actually standing on the set in between shots. And that's one of the things sometimes it's a little subversive about being a photographer. You can get close and you can listen and you can hear things. You know, I've always felt that that was sacred and you don't tell. Mm-hmm. All right. Now that they're both gone, I think I will share it. During the break, James Brown was noticing, you know, that everybody was deferring, obviously, to Don.
Yeah.
And at one point, you know, he asks him, who are you with? Well, what do you mean, James? Well, who are you with? Who's backing you on this? And it wasn't until I was putting this book together that I realized that I might have captured an important little historical footnote in black music. Don knew what James meant, and Don, you know, said, it's me. It's only me behind, you know, who's doing this. But James Brown was asking if Don was being assisted by backers who were primarily not of the colored persuasion. And the answer was, James, it's just me.
That's a moment of real realization, right? It's like, oh, we can, not only can sing a dance, we can do the whole thing.
We can, as they say, we can four-wall it. Because you see, what that meant was Don paid for everything, and then he went out and sold it, and he owned his product. This was not Don going to ABC and making a deal. Nobody wanted to make a deal with Don back then.
There's a photo in the book of, yes, Isaac Hayes with a saxophone, chainmail vest is the only thing I could call it, sort of in his Shaft era,
yes,
glory. Isaac Hayes, you know, wrote the theme to Shaft and was a singer-songwriter and a musician.
This is my first R&B photo that I took, and
you're up in his grill. Like, how do you get there?
I was 2 feet away from him. How do you get there? Stupidity. Not understanding that you're not supposed to be there. Not understanding that two security guys could have picked me up and tossed me out, but they didn't. It was the end of the show. I actually got up on the stage, was crawling around these boxes, the road cases, you know, that the, mm-hmm, instruments are in. And he was actually playing at that moment. So there I was.
And there's a photo in the book of a young Bruce Tolliman standing near Isaac. I mean, you're under the piano almost.
I'm 2 feet away. And I just knew that that was what I was supposed to do for the rest of my life.
We're listening to the interview our guest contributor Sonari Glinton recorded with Bruce Tolliman. His music photos from 1972 to 82 are collected in the book Soul, R&B, Funk. We'll hear more of their interview after a break. This is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor E-Trade. Investing your money shouldn't require moving mountains, no matter how much or how little experience you have. E-Trade makes investing simple. Along with great value, they provide the tools and support you need to navigate the markets, all to help your money work hard for you. For more information, visit eTrade.com/NPR. E-Trade Securities, LLC. Member SIPC. Support also comes from BetterHelp. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who specialize in issues such as depression, stress, anxiety, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment at your convenience. Get help at your own time and your own pace. Schedule secure video or phone sessions, plus chat and text with your therapist. Visit BetterHelp.com/freshair to learn more and get 10% off your first month.
Let's get back to the interview our guest contributor Sonari Glinton recorded with Bruce Talaman. His book, Soul, R&B, Funk, collects his photos of musicians from 1972 to 82.
It's clear looking through the book that you have a relationship with these artists, right? And if the positive side is the intimacy, then you have to develop trust. What are the trade-offs then? You know, to get this close, to get this intimate, as someone, you know, as a journalist, I think, well, are there trade-offs? Are, hey, Bruce, don't take this photo. Hey, like, what do you have to trade? What did you
I was never asked to put my camera down. One of the things I learned early was that you not mess up the vibe and maybe don't get too close. You know, you can always put a longer lens on, you know. Pay attention. It's all around you. And if you're in the room, the shot will come. But you have to pay attention. You have to be aware of everything that's going on. One of the things that a couple of people told me was that they liked the fact that I didn't burst into a room and just start photographing. You have to lay back. Just wait. I've used that, and it's been good for me.
How do you not mess up the vibe then? You say that's your key, is like, I knew not to mess up the vibe. How do you not mess up
in other words,
cool people. These are people who you might think are actually cool.
They are very cool. Look, there's a lot of folks walking around with cameras. There's only a few photographers, all right? And you gotta learn, you know, how you go about it. There's a certain style to it. And, you know, you learn from, you know, people like Gordon Parks, or you learn from, you know, Bob Willoughby or David Douglas Duncan. These were the people that I looked at their work, and I basically put myself to school, you know, and I would look and I would see how they would tell a photo story and how you would use your lenses. And quite frankly, the photographer who had an impact on me was one of the ones was Jim Marshall. He of the rock and roll.
Yeah, the rock and roll photographer. He took my favorite photos of Mick and Keith, et cetera.
In 1972. But I mean, you know, Janice and Jimmy at Monterey, and then later at Woodstock. And he used a Leica camera, because a Leica doesn't make that loud clack. You know, it's a much quieter shutter that you have, and also it's unobtrusive. It's smaller than a Nikon or a Canon. And the lenses were just superb. And it almost sort of disappears in your hand. So there's not that red flag of, oh, he's got a camera.
Oh, he's got, and a big camera with a big lens.
And a huge camera, and a camera that goes, chicka-chicka-chicka-chicka. No, you don't, you know, you don't do that. You don't fire off 20 shots in backstage in the dressing room.
You tell a story, your first professional mm-hmm. photograph, actually. You take a photo of Miles Davis when I was
a college student, and actually that wasn't really a professional job. That was just Bruce wanting to go down and get a better position and a better seat. I mean, I was sitting at the feet of Miles Davis.
Oh, so you're at a, you go to a concert.
I was
to see
at a
Miles
concert
Davis.
I had bought a camera in Berlin. I was on an exchange program for Whittier College, and I had bought a camera for $150, all my little money that I had at the time, and I used up all my little, for those of you who don't remember, American Express traveler's checks, but I had my little American Express traveler's checks, and I wrote them all out and bought the camera. We were at the University of Copenhagen, and Miles was coming to play at Tivoli Gardens, which is a big venue in Copenhagen. And the brothers wanted to go see Miles. So we go, and we were in the cheap seats because we didn't have any money. And I decided to go down to the front. Well, I walked down to the front and an usher stops me and he says, you have to go back to your seat. And I said, well, actually, I'm from Jet Magazine, an American publication. Looked the man straight in the face and lied. Sorry, Mom. But he said, okay, and then allowed me to proceed down. And during the concert, I photographed Miles. I was, I don't know, two or three feet away from him. And he's in the front, or, you know, front part of the stage. And there came a moment when the photographer, the Danish newspaper photographer, took, Miles was doing a solo. He had the mute on the solo. It was intimate. It was quiet. It was subtle. And the photographer fires off with a Nikon motor drive right in the middle of the solo.
And then that would be like click, 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 click.
Click, 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 click.
Okay.
Miles didn't say a word. He just emptied a spit valve on the guy. And
that's gross. And Miles Davis is a
That's pretty gross. But then he turns and he looks at me and he says, you can stay. Oh, baby, I was done. Okay? I was like floating on air.
And then, just to be clear, I want to say, when I say that it's gross, the spit valve is when you're a performer, like the spit collects
in
the trumpet and the horn. And so a lot of it can collect, and you can see musicians when you're emptying them on the side of the stage and they have places for them. So to do that is possibly one of, I mean, can you, I mean, I just.
The point was that the artist was insulted. And also the guy, he could have gotten, you know, you didn't need to do that. Okay? As a chronicler or as a recorder of this moment, I learned, you know, stay out of the way and don't mess up the vibe. And so, you know, there we were. And that's something that I've always, I mean, it's taken me to many places.
Bruce Solomon, thank you so much.
You are welcome. Thank you.
Bruce Talaman's book is called Soul, R&B, Funk, Photographs 1972-82. He spoke with our guest contributor, Sonari Glinton. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, we'll talk about debunking a conspiracy theory. Our guest will be investigative journalist Michael Isikoff, who uncovered what he describes as the previously unreported role of Russian intelligence in creating and fostering one of the most insidious conspiracy theories that arose out of the 2016 election, a conspiracy theory that was promoted by some of Donald Trump's allies. I hope you'll join us. It's a pleasure to end today's show with some good news. Our producer, Heidi Simon, has brought Remy Rafat Tannenbaum into the world. Baby and mother are doing great. It was wonderful witnessing her pregnancy, and now we all look forward to seeing the next chapter of her life as a new mother. She's only been gone a few days. She worked until nearly the last minute, but we miss her already. We look forward to her return and to meeting Remy. Congratulations to Heidi and her husband, Joel. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our associate producer for digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.